Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining wherever you may be around the world. Today is time for another author interview. I am joined by fantasy author Abigail Morrison, the author of The Yokne's Eye. And I had to double check the spelling, but you make that very clear on your on your social media page. That's how you pronounce it. So, Abby, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, the pleasure is all mine. So your debut novel, The Yokne's Eye, came out last year, and you're also entered into the SPIFBO, that's self-published fantasy blog off competition hosted by Mark Lawrence. He's been doing it for a number of years. It's had great success. Could you tell me a little bit about your experience with that competition, how accessible it is to new authors, and just some general feedback for maybe some new authors looking to join that competition?
Yeah, I think it's very accessible for authors to join the SPIFBO competition. If you go to Mark's page, he'll have information on when he'll provide like more specific instructions. You got to be quick. filled up super fast this year. So I had to do it like immediately before leaving for my job because he's in a very different time zone than I am. So that was the only big challenge to get in. I think I was not fully prepared to be in it in the sense of I would see a lot of posts on Twitter of collections of SPIFBO books or books that were on sale for SPIFBO. And I just was like, I don't know how to plug into this at all. Obviously, as a new author, I'm learning the ropes. I unfortunately did not get a review. My reviewer, Team Bookborn, and then subsequently another woman, kind of just disappeared. So I just at this point, I just hope she's okay. So that was a little bit of a challenge for me in this competition, but it's been really cool to see all the people that are willing to read. Tom Mock is reading all the first chapters, which is just nuts. There's lots of different booktubers who have read all of the first sentences. I know Dominish did that. Lots of different people getting involved. So if you can plug into those and figure out how to do that, which I did not until it was a little late for me, then I think it's a great way to get a lot of visibility. And everyone is super nice that I've seen involved with it so far. So that's been great.
Yeah, my experience with it, I was a judge two competitions ago, so I know the process, and you see a lot of works you probably would never see otherwise. So it's a great way to grow not only the community but new authors and just get more experience out there. So glad it went okay with you. Holding up the Yokne's Eye with me right now, it is a YA fantasy adventure, and you throw a few twists in there, but we're not going to get into the spoiler territory here. So could you tell the audience just a little bit about it, kind of like your 2-minute elevator pitch of what the story is about, and then we can get into the nitty-gritty.
Sure. So The Yokne's Eye, like you said, is a YA fantasy book. It's about these three rival champions that are on a journey to reach a creature that can change one thing about the world whenever it blinks. That would be the Yokne, but it only blinks once every 600 years. So you have this really huge kind of Hunger Games competition type thing every 600 years with lots of different groups vying to be basically the last person in front of the Yokne when it blinks, because then you get to make your wish and change something potentially super massive about the world, or you could just ask for a Klondike bar if you wanted to. It's kind of up to them.
Cool. And it's a very fast-paced book. It's definitely a page-turner. It'll make you laugh. That's throughout the chapters. And by far, my favorite character was definitely Mira. Mira is not the quintessential dwarf woman, because when you think of dwarfs, you think short, stocky men with long beards, and they got big axes, and they got like a lot of muscle, and they're drinking lots of beer. Mira is not like that at all. Although she is short, she has blonde
she's
hair.
Got an axe. She's got that.
She does have an axe, and she just by far like my favorite character in the story. Tell us a little bit about her and how you constructed her in your mind first thinking about this story.
Yeah, so Mira Part of what I wanted to do with this book, because I tend to write a lot of male characters and my writer friends kind of tease me that I just love dudes so much. And I really wanted to kind of write from a female perspective for this one and write a female main character. She kind of splits the role of main character, I would say, with Atlan. So that was part of it. And then I thought, you never see, it's rare to, I think it's rare to see dwarves as a main character in anything, let alone a female dwarf. And when they're around, it's usually like, haha, they have a beard, Lord of the Rings style. And so I wanted to have a different take on them. And yeah, I think she is a good other half to Atlan as they're kind of coping with some of the global issues of oppression and injustice that come through in the book. Her people are enslaved, so her wish is basically, let's just get rid of our enslavers. So yeah, I was excited to dive into that side of things. It was interesting to write as her because I'm very fortunate that I haven't really ever had to deal with any kind of major oppression in my life. So trying to write about that in a way that felt sincere and real to me, and in a way where I could find pieces that connect to her. She's very angry. She's got some anger issues. And so being able to, and I'm not a super angry person myself most of the time. I try not to be. And so trying to find ways to connect with that and not just make her a caricature or make her very one note. That was a comment my editor came back with, is she was very one note. And then I realized it's just because all of the internal changes weren't coming on the page. So I had to make sure that they were written there to give her a little bit more complexity. But she's a lot of fun. A lot of people like her. She's kind of a different sort of strong female protagonist, I guess.
Yeah, she's not your typical damsel in distress or like high princess who looking to be saved or wants to tackle the world. She comes at it from a different perspective. That's what people love about her. And then she's 16 years old. So she's got that like young spunk. She doesn't like taking no for an answer. There is like a conflict towards the beginning of the book and she doesn't take well to that, but it all gets resolved and it shoots towards the ending. The next character I was introduced to was actually Craven and Drake. Those are some fun characters. I had to ask about Craven because when you introduce him, he's speaking in a language that's not known to us. And he speaks it for a good amount of time, even during his conversations with Mira. And this is not a critique, but it got to the point where I thought it was going on forever. It's like, is he ever going to speak normal so I can understand? So talk to me a little bit about Craven and just like the wanting to have this conversation in another language for like multiple chapters at a time, sort of that.
Yeah. Craven is really interesting because he was my trouble character this book, where for a really long time, I had a lot of difficulty locking in on him. I had a lot of debate with myself of whether or not I needed him in the book at all. When I started with him, I think he was this very wishy-washy, I just want to do good and save everybody because I just do. And he really evolved into someone who struggles with that ideology a lot more. So it was interesting to try to find a place for him on the spectrum of kind of how to deal with this issue and having him land somewhere in the middle, but not in a way that was indifferent to the issues that are happening. And it was also very difficult with the language barrier. So he basically speaks French. I call it Fransec in the book, but it's French. And so that was a huge challenge for me because obviously I had to have my dear friend Beth make sure that I translated things correctly, but then also being able to do it at a level where hopefully readers didn't get super frustrated or I can't understand at all what he's saying. Or one of the problems that came out of that was actually that in the earlier drafts, he was really disengaged from everything. As soon as Atlan showed up, he basically just dropped off the map because he didn't understand what they were saying. So he didn't know what was going on either. And so it was very difficult for Craven to be involved in the plot when he didn't understand the plot that was happening to him in the moment. So I actually did give him a phrase book eventually so he could kind of follow certain things. It was fun to go through and be like, which words in English and French are very similar. So he might be able to guess which ones are close. Thankfully, champion is the same. So that was an easier one for him. But yeah, that was really a challenging thing. And there's a reason why I gave him this other language, which ties in with Atlan, the third main character. So I had a coworker who was reading it and was like, wow, you are putting in a lot of work for what seems like not a lot of payoff for him to just not understand. And then once Atlan came on the scene, she was like, oh, okay, I understand a little bit better why you did this. So hopefully it wasn't frustrating for you. I'm open to feedback if it was just like, I don't understand and I'm just going to skim past, or interesting. I don't know. I was a little worried about it, but I went for it anyway. And then Drake is his sea dragon, Drake, and he's a lot of fun. I think of him pretty much like Pegasus from the Disney movie Hercules. He's kind of the wise animal companion who sometimes just has a more intuitive wisdom than anybody else in the story. So he was a lot of fun to write, figuring out the size problems with him and him being in a not sea or aquatic environment for a lot of the time was kind of fun and interesting to work into things as well.
And no, Craven, my interactions with him, it was just like, I felt like it was like a couple chapters too long to get it. But then once Atlan came into the picture, then it all started to click. But on the flip side, once by doing this language barrier, how do people communicate with each other? They do like, they use their hands, they use signs, they try to find commonality, which if you go to any foreign country, I was recently in Portugal, trying to find similar words and similar phrases to just go off each other. A lot of the human language is not based off of speak. It's based off of gestures. It makes facial expressions, stuff like that. So it was just a different way to convey that to the audience. So I think I enjoyed it more than I'm letting on, but I just wanted to tease
it a little bit. Good. I'm glad. Yeah, it was interesting too with like the hand gestures, because I had to think what would be universal hand gestures. Like one of the first things he asked her is, you know, are you willing to like travel with me? And I was like, well, how do you ask that when you don't have the language and you don't want to go through this phrase book for forever? So that was kind of a challenge. Or even when I was trying to find translations to use in the book, either trying to put contextual clues around it enough for people to be able to follow without feeling like they had to go translate it, or trying to choose the word that was like closest to the English version, or repeating phrases. So if they could just latch on to like a couple, they could sort of follow along a little bit. So trying to ease their burden was definitely top of mind, whether or not I succeeded.
I think you did quite well. So
thank
all
you.
Good. And the final character, main character we talked about is, of course, Atlan. He's the High Prince and heir to the Bogey Empire. He enters the picture after we meet Mira and Craven. And originally, Mira sees him as an enemy, but then they make like sort of like a contract, and then they go make their way towards the Yokni. Tell us about Atlan from Construction, and what makes him, in your eyes, such a great character.
Yeah, Atlan, I think, might be my favorite character. I think he's the one that I most readily sympathize with and understand on a very base level. So a bogey, which I'm so sorry to any of my English listeners for this show. I know bogey means something else in England, but he is a giant dog man, basically. So not quite a werewolf, but similar humanoid dog person, very broad-shouldered, waspish waist. And yeah, he is the heir to this kingdom empire that has enslaved the Dwarven people. And I think what interested me about Atlan was, and the bogeys in general, is I was really interested in writing this leader character who not only has to deal with some of the things that his empire is doing, but also him being in a position of power in a pretty bad empire. Like, they're not great. They're doing some real terrible things. and him being in a position to change that and have the power to change that, but also being someone who is like actually worthy to rule in this empire, even if he needs to make sweeping changes, which he should. So that was something that interested me keenly, is this idea of what does a good king look like? I think traditional fantasy stories seem to be more like, yay, kings are awesome. And then as we've gotten a little farther along in society, I think it's often they can be seen as like, they're the unworthy king, or they're weak, or they're abusive, or whatever. And so I was interested in writing a king character that is actually worthy of his role and title, and how he needs to interact with the people that are under him in the kingdom in a way that is responsible and loving and caring and righteous and doing the right thing as a leader with people who are quote unquote like rightfully under him. And when I say that, I don't mean that like enslaving the dwarves is right. Obviously that is wrong, but a king has subjects. That's like his role, is to have subjects. And so how does he rightfully manage something that is correct to his position of authority over people? Similar, like a modern day example is like, how do you write a good boss character? Like, it's right that they have employees. So how does he rightfully manage his employees, as it were? And then the bogeys themselves, I think a lot of where this story came out of was kind of a reaction and response to a lot of these rebellion stories that I see in young adults a lot of the time, which is basically, this is a bad group of people that's in charge, so how do we just like overcome them and just get rid of them? So Star Wars is a classic example. Hunger Games is a huge example. I feel bad. I really enjoyed Hunger Games, but I kind of use it as this example of like what I was reacting to, which is kind of weird because I do love it. And I think there's a great place for those, but I think sometimes there's so many of them that it encourages a narrative in society that the only way to address problems is to get rid of the other side, which I think is a bad lesson to tell people. And I think that we should be working towards working together to solve problems. And so I was really interested in exploring that idea in this book with people being wronged in a situation, and the people that are doing the wrong, and how can they come together to fix it instead of just wiping one side out. And so the bogeys to me were an example of being able to potentially redeem someone who's doing wrong, and also just the general risk that's involved in that. So for Mira to make certain decisions that she makes later in the book just involves opening herself up to be vulnerable, to potentially be hurt by this person that she, you know, goes into the situation thinking is horrible. And she has to decide whether she's going to open up and potentially expose herself to that, or if she's going to, you know, not. So yeah, that's Atlan. he's lovely. Big fan.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing. Since you mentioned that you read a lot of YA fantasy, I was curious, why did you decide to write your novel as YA? Because you have a lot of themes that are more adult leaning, but you're focusing on this sub-genre. I'm just curious.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is that my reading preferences have always skewed younger. I read a lot of young adult and actually a lot of middle grade, if it's good. And I think some of that is my personal preferences of like, I really don't like bedroom scenes when I'm reading. And so like, I can avoid a lot of that by just staying in YA and things like that. I think also to that point, I think this is I don't want to say a message, because I try not to be preachy in my writing. I try to just be like, here's the thing. Here's what people did about the thing. How do you feel about the thing? And hopefully I achieved that to some degree in this book. But it is maybe a counter perspective that I in particular wanted to expose young adult readers to, because I find that some of these rebellion tales are heavily skewed in young adult. And again, I don't read a lot of adult novels, so I'm sure there's loads of them out there. I mean, it's not like Star Wars is a young adult story either. But I think there was like a rash of them with Hunger Games of, you know, young teens who instinctively know what is the correct moral thing to do despite being raised in super amoral situations, overthrow their horrible older generation overlords and just murder their way to victory in a new world. And I was like, maybe let's not tell all of our teenagers that the way to like solve problems is by murdering people you disagree with. So some of it was me just being super self-insertion-y about my opinions into that audience. And some of it is just a content level of what I'm comfortable with writing myself, what I enjoy reading. And I think in general, young adult has always appealed to me because it's an age where it's so ripe for character development. It's when people really start to decide how they feel about certain things, or they start to confront some of the things that they've been raised with. And so I think it's always been a genre that is, to me, offers a lot of room for some of the ultra drama that I'm super there for. But also just those like first experiences, you know, and that could be a first kiss, or, you know, your first brush with the law, or, you know, your whatever it is, it's an opportunity where people are just growing and learning so much that I think telling stories about those people as they figure those things out is a great way to examine the themes that they're exploring, because they're not set in their ways yet and they're open to change and shifting opinions in ways that older characters might struggle with, without a little bit more force to make them change, if that makes sense.
Yes, it makes a ton of sense. Thank you for sharing. Since you are my first YA fantasy author I've had on my podcast, I wanted to ask you something in the publishing world related to female authors, particularly because I've had a couple female authors on my podcast, and I read a lot of epic fantasy by them. When they first enter the market and they're trying to market their book, I don't know if there's still, I mean, I think there might be an inherent bias for people when they see, oh, a female fantasy author must be YA. They kind of get like funneled into that subgenre, fairly or unfairly. I think most of the times it's unfairly. I'm just wondering, what's your opinion on that? Is this a problem still in the industry? And if you have a way to possibly correct it, what are your two cents on that?
Oh boy, what a wonderful question. I haven't thought about it that much. I think my impression is typically that young adult does tend to skew more towards female adult readers, certainly. And so it doesn't surprise me terribly to know that a lot of young adult authors are female. I mean, there are certainly some young adult authors that are male that I can think of. Jonathan Stroud, Garth Nix, Neil Gaiman has certainly done some young adult stuff-ish before. So I guess I don't know that it's a problem. I think to me, I'm kind of like, write what you want to write and read what you want to read. So if that's just how the dice fall, it doesn't bother me. I've never had an experience where I've felt that someone has told me I couldn't write adult stuff. I just choose not to, because I think it's slightly less interesting to me. And even books that I've written in the past that feature adult characters, I think have a more young adult tone to them, and I would feel comfortable potentially, I'd have to think about that more, marketing them to young adult readers, because I'm to the point of read what you want to read. I think if a teenager wants to read a story about, you know, 40-year-old characters, why not? Like, go for it. Does that answer your question? I haven't thought about that at all. I'm so fascinated by this.
No, yes, it does. I was actually referring more towards the marketing of their work instead of marking it towards like more adult. Like, I don't know the statistics on it, but a lot of people who read, you know, like a lot of epic fantasy, I think it skews slightly more male than female. And conversely, on the YA side, I think the numbers are opposite. So it's when they're pitching a book and they're trying to see what's the best market to release this to, I think the default is to put it towards more YA, even though it might not be. It may be epic fantasy for adults. I was going along the lines of that, but
oh yeah, I mean, I think it's hard because young adult is such a any kind of specific age related genre is kind of goofy to me because I feel like to me what I've understood is that the YA genre is a book that is featuring young adult like age characters. Whether so it's outside of things like the tone of the book or vocabulary or content. I mean, content is certainly a huge aspect with YA. You know, you're not going to market something to like 12-year-olds that has like explicit erotica in it or something, or at least not probably do it very successfully. But I've always had this feeling that it should be more about what would appeal to a young adult reader. And so that's actually been really difficult for me in marketing The Yokney's Eye because it's got like two mild instances of language in it, and then it has violence in it. And I feel like I'm not very good at gauging like the violence age range. You know, I have a nephew who loves super violent video games, and you know, and I was like, so is he fine like reading about it? I don't know. So, but I've had a lot of readers that are 10 that have just loved this book, and I was not trying to market to them at all. I was like, I should probably do like 12 and up, you know, probably that middle grade to young adult crossover. And I've had a lot of success with actually younger readers, but then I also have a lot of adults who really enjoy it. And they, you know, some of them have been like, it's almost too much for me on the violence, but then I've never had that problem with the kids. So it has been a really interesting thing as I'm just starting to learn how to do Amazon ads, which is just a whole ocean of things to jump into. It's been interesting to try to choose how to market it, of like, what keywords do I put? What age range do I put on the book in Ingram and Amazon? Because it is kind of this broad reaching thing, even if the characters themselves are in this young adult range. And because of their age, I've tried to go young adult. That has had for me any relation to like my gender, but it's just more like my personal preferences. But it is something that I would market as far as like interest level and content to adults also. So it's kind of a weird, young adult specifically is a really weird one for that kind of thing. But yeah, I do think it's definitely skews more towards women with readers, and probably consequently authors for sure. And certainly marketing to them more.
Yeah, I definitely get that and see that. But some of my favorite, one of my favorite authors, he released a YA sci-fi series, Brandon Sanderson, the Skyward books. Love those. I read, and besides yours, I read one earlier last year, Little White Hands by Mark Cushions. That was a lot of fun. And actually on audio, I'm going to call myself out. I'm currently listening to like the whole series of The Guardians of Gahul. They are fantastic. And very, even though it's YA, there's some dark scenes in it. I'm not sure it's definitely for children, but no, I'm always getting kicked out of that. And it's always nice to see something. Sometimes a book doesn't have to be like deep themes, makes you think, makes you want to like sit there for like an hour afterwards. Sometimes you just want to read something for fun and experience something new. So, and yours definitely does that. Well, in all this questions back and forth, I forgot to ask you, like, How did you start, and what made you want to become a writer in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, my writing instinct has been with me always. So since I was probably in third grade and got compliments and then was like, ooh, I like compliments. Yes, please. But I've always had this love for story and storytelling. I think growing up, I was really inspired by Redwall. Brian Jake's always been a big fan of that. Garth Nix's Aberson trilogy was really influential on me, and I just wanted to be able to do that and create these worlds that didn't exist before. But as far as getting started, it took me a long, well, I started, it took me a long time to finish. So I would say it took me about 10 years to get my first book out. And certainly The Yokney's Eye was not all 10 years of that. I was probably 3 years of actual work, and I finished Rough Draft in 2017. It came out August 2022. So you know, but there was a gap where I wasn't working on it. But it just took me a long time to learn to be teachable enough to learn what I was actually doing and how to do it correctly. So I spent a lot of time floundering with other books that just did not work because I refused to learn how to actually learn how to write a book that worked. So pro tip, don't do that. So yeah, it's always been there. It just took me a long time to actually be like, buddy, you gotta get something out there. Otherwise, what are you doing wasting your time? So I eventually kicked myself in the booty enough to get it out there.
Well, it's the fact that you got it out there is the most important part. So don't hit yourself too hard. And during that whole time, 10 plus years or the 3 years of actually writing, did you have the story all written out? Or I'm asking, are you more of a plotter or a pantser, or is it a combination of two?
Yeah, I'm a pantser that would desperately like to convert to being a plotter, but is a hard leap. So I think for me, I tend to need a beginning and an ending. And I might have a few set piece kind of things in mind. But I can rarely put them in any kind of significant order. I do find after I'm done, I got really into StoryGrid for a while. And so that's been really helpful to just put everything on an Excel doc to be able to have this more meticulous scientific approach to editing. Because before then it was, and before I knew how to plot a book, which was really the biggest struggle for me, was learning how to plot. I was kind of just like, I'm going to edit whatever line doesn't sound good and focus mostly on that line level when the actual bones of it weren't working. So I'd say in the ones that I'm working on now, I have now that I've done it to completion all the way through one time, that has completely unlocked this new skill set for me where I'm finding, and now that I took a class on plot structure and read books and things like that, it has helped me to more intuitively know as I'm writing if it's working or not. I've gotten a lot better at being able to figure out if a certain rabbit trail I'm on is going somewhere or if it's just like, nah, you need to just cut that branch off right now and keep going. I've gotten a lot better at that, but as far as being able to completely plot something out in advance, I haven't mastered that skill yet. Some of it is also just because I'm creating worlds from whole cloth a lot of the time. It's just, I don't know enough about the world yet to be able to say what would be the possible conflicts and subvillains and whatever that would crop up until they just show up and say, hey, I'm here, include me, please. So that's been an interesting challenge, but I am trying to get certainly better and faster at figuring out the plot either as I go or analyzing it when I'm done.
Excellent. And with figuring out all this plot stuff, is there any new, you have one book in the books, do you have any new mm-hmm. projects either you're thinking about or on the horizon or plan, anything you care to share?
Yes, I do. So I'm currently working on my first series, which is fun and exciting and scary all at the same time. So I think that will be a 5-book series. Lord help me, I think it's going to be 5. So we'll see how that goes. I've got the first 3 in rough draft form. I'm currently working on just a lighter story grid to kind of get the basics of what's on the page. I had this extreme flurry of activity at the end of the year. So I'm now trying to be like, okay, but what did I actually write? And have that contained, kind of get a little bit more familiar with the flow of those before writing the next 2. So those ones are going to be still YA, but the setting is, I would say it's like adjacent to semi-dystopian steampunk is kind of the vibe, but they don't use steam, it's a different power source, but kind of that vibe. I've had people compare it to Wool or Silo a little bit, but I have been careful not to read them because I don't want to get in trouble having people think I stole stuff from them. So I'll probably read them after I get those out. But yeah, I don't have a deadline on on when I want to publish those, because this is my first series, and because, again, it is that world that's kind of cut from whole cloth, I want to get all of the rough drafts done instead of kind of trying to do them one at a time, just so I don't accidentally screw myself up later by things I included or didn't include in the first book. I'd really like to have everything really fully laid out, whether or not that's the good or professional strategy that other people who write series regularly use or not. I'm still learning, so I'm really excited for that. And then I would like to go back for some of the work in progress ones that I had in that intervening 10 years. So a lot of them need a lot of updates. Some of them were like clearly written by like a lonely teenage high schooler, so they need some like serious updating. They're pretty cheesy, and just the plotting is a mess. Some of the characters, you know, as I've gotten older, I'm like, humans just don't work that way. So, but I think there is good potential in them, so I'd like to get some of those out. And some of those are standalones, and then I have one that's sort of a duology, but they're more like just two standalones that take place in the same world one after another, rather than this is the full plot. It requires two books. So yeah, lots of projects on the horizon. I just gotta knuckle down and do them. So I'm excited to.
Yeah, and we'll all be excited to read them, and me especially. And having all the rough drafts done before, and it's not as uncommon as you think. I believe Brent Weeks did it with his Night Angel trilogy. All three of them were done. One of my favorite authors, P.L. Stewart, Drowned Kingdom Saga, he has all the rough drafts for his 7-book series already done, and he's just editing it one per year. I think L.L. Stevens also has it with her 6-book series as well. I have to double check on that one. So you're in pretty good company. So
good to know.
This has been great. One final question, and I'm pretty sure you've anticipated this question. Do you have any suggestions for any works or novels that are quote unquote under the radar that people should have an eye on and should take a look at?
Yes, I do. So this will definitely benefit anyone who is more in that young adult vein or jonesing for some of that. So I have 4 suggestions. So Kristen A. Oakley, she's a friend of mine. She's doing YA dystopian in a setting where evil is like a quantified substance that they can take out of other people and put into a single evil person to help everyone else have peace. Pat Daly does the Spark series, and so that's kind of gamer teens rescue augmented reality Disneyland from terrorists. And so it's kind of somewhat dystopian lit RPG somewhere in that vein. My dear friend Beth Flaherty, who not only helped me with this book, Pat also helped with this one. Well, actually, all 3 of those people helped with this one. She's actually going to be publishing her first book at the end of the year. So she does kind of, I think she's going to market it as adult, but her characters are like later teens. So kind of in that mid-space, high epic fantasy. So that'll be coming out later this year. And then Heather Dixon is someone that I don't know, but she does really good YA stuff that is it. One of them is kind of steampunky-ish, but with like alternate realities. One of them is kind of the gothic fairy tale sort of vibe. And then she has another one based off of the Nutcracker, I think, that I haven't read yet. But she just has this really beautiful lyrical style to her. Her characters are just so charming, and the settings are really unique and fun. And the second one that I mentioned, I can't remember the name of it. That one has a bunch of people who dance in it, and I really like dancing. So it was really nice to read a book about this lady who clearly knows her stuff, describing all these different dances of like these 12 sisters that are just really into it, just super into dancing. So that one's kind of fun if you're looking for maybe that more Regency romance-y with a fairy tale twist. So yeah, those are all excellent writers that I would recommend.
Awesome. If you're a YA fantasy reader, be sure to check those out. Well, Abby, this has been super fun. Could you tell the audience where they can find you, your social media handles, your website, and where they could find The Yolk Needs Eye?
Yeah. So the best place to find me is at my website, amorrisonbooks.com. That's where you can sign up for my newsletter, which I'm trying to be a little bit more diligent with this year. So yeah, that's the best way to keep in touch as far as what I'm up to. I am technically on Twitter at the Miss Morrison, but I'm not necessarily a frequent flyer. So the newsletter is best. And then the Yokney's Eye is available on Amazon. You can buy direct from me if you want to get signed copies or the super cute stickers. You get a sticker for free with every book purchase, or you can get the full sticker set, which is Drake, Craven, Mira, and Atlan, or other places that use Ingram Spark. So Barnes & Noble and other major distributors that would use Ingram will have the book for order as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Abby, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for hopping on. And whenever you get to publishing your new books, be sure to let us know, and we'll love to have you back on to talk about it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Blaze. It has been a pleasure, and you do really awesome things.
Thank you so much, and cheers, everybody.